Hello and welcome to the third episode of Season 8 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I am Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello there, Ray.
We really can't ignore it any longer, can we?
Well, not really, Ray. It's been dominating the news cycle, our social media feeds, and much of the conversation for the past couple of weeks. So it must be time to throw in our two pennyworth, I guess.
Yep. And in case anyone listening has been out of the country or off the planet for the last few days, we are, of course, talking about the Pandora Papers.
We most certainly are. But can we begin, Ray, by talking about Pandora? I mean, she is in some ways just an excellent metaphor for the way some stories can get bent out of shape from their original form.
Yeah, she is, isn't she? If you mention the name of Pandora to most people, they'll reply along the lines of, what, the woman with the box?
Yes, and ignoring the cheap one-liner there.
Well done.
Change, thank you. My response to that is, but Pandora never had a box.
We're going to have to tread carefully here, aren't we?
I know you can do it, Ray. So what is the real story?
According to Greek mythology, Pandora was the first human woman. Her name means all gifts. It's a long story, but she was created on the orders of Zeus, and she was bestowed all manner of gifts from the gods. And I think it would be as well if the gods had kept the receipts.
Yes, because it wasn't just good things that she was given, was it?
No, Graham. She was also the possessor of all manner of misery and evil, which she kept in a jar.
In a jar, not in a box?
No, a jar. In the original Greek, it was called a pithos, and that's the way it stayed right up until the 16th century.
Well, what happened then?
Erasmus of Rotterdam happened then, Graham. He either mistranslated or misunderstood the story and substituted pixis, meaning a box, instead of pithos, and it stuck.
And that's why we now talk about opening Pandora's box rather than Pandora's jar.
Exactly. And that underlines yet again why you should always go back to the source to validate or verify your understanding and not rely on second-hand reporting.
Exactly. So, Ray, what was the significance of the jar?
Pandora had been instructed never to open the jar, but not told why.
Oh, can't help feeling that was a mistake. So what happened?
Well, when she was created, she was made to be not just beautiful, but also curious. And her curiosity got the better of her, which caused her to open the box. Well, technically, unstopper the jar.
You're telling this story, Ray, like it actually happened.
That's the only way with stories, Graham. And by unstoppering the jar, she released all those evils into the world. But that wasn't all.
Oh.
No, the gods had also placed hope inside the jar, meaning that alongside all these terrible things like sickness, jealousy, strife, hatred, etc., humans were also bestowed with hope.
Oh, which lives with us still.
Well, some days are better than others, Graham, but just about, I would say.
Yes. So I think with that story in mind, Ray, and it was a lovely story and very well told, if you don't mind saying, well, I think we should set about giving our hopefully thoughtful opinion on the papers that now bear her name.
So shall we start with some background?
Well, we usually do, Ray.
Right then. Now, the leak consists of nearly 12 million documents from 14 different sources, which have been investigated by more than 600 journalists in 117 countries over the last 18 months.
Wow. And I think the first thing worth noting is how well those journalists kept it a secret. I mean, they may be good at extracting leaks, but they're also extremely good at not leaking them themselves.
Indeed. The leak includes nearly 6.5 million documents, around 3 million images, more than 1 million emails, and almost 500,000 spreadsheets.
500,000 spreadsheets. I mean, that is kind of close to heaven for you, isn't it? half a million spreadsheets.
Yeah.
And that gives you some idea of the scale of the challenge in reporting them. You can't just sit down and read all that lot, even with 600 journalists and 18 months of lead time.
Well, exactly. Some sort of search criteria had to be used to extract the stories we've so far seen.
Yes, which also suggests over the coming months and years, there will be further, potentially even more revealing stories to follow, albeit not necessarily centred on world leaders or other politically exposed people, which I fancy, Ray, was probably the initial search criteria.
I agree. And we should talk about the 14 different sources of these documents, most of which appear to be trust and company service providers.
Yeah. So was this one leaker or was it many? Mm. If it was one, how did they get access to all this material? And if it was many, did they act in concert, given it all appears to have been leaked at pretty much the same time?
Now, I guess given the incredible strictness with which media outlets protect their whistleblowers, we may never know.
And if it means, Ray, that these brave people stay safe, that is fair enough. What else do we know?
Well, so far, more than 330 politicians from 90 different countries have been identified within the documents.
And that also tells a story, doesn't it? Mm. It strongly suggests that this is not an issue confined to any one group or any one geographical location. The existence of offshore attracts the attention of the rich and famous, along with the corrupt and infamous, from all over the globe.
And that's a point we need to pick up on. Self-evidently, not everyone using offshore structures is corrupt or criminal.
No, not everyone using offshore is an international financial criminal, but just about every international financial criminal uses offshore, Ray.
Ah, I see what you did there, Graham. But there are non-criminal uses nonetheless.
There are, but the reasons for using them almost always points to some benefit that is not readily available to the likes of you or me. Whether you like it or not, they are divisive.
Mm, in as much as they divide the haves from the have-nots, yes. For the haves, they provide excellent opportunities to save tax, maintain secrecy, and provide a safe haven for their money when they live in locations where the rule of law is not secure.
Yeah, but as is the nature of these things, those who seek to circumvent the law are usually the first to spot the opportunity, and offshore provides them with a perfect opportunity.
Secrecy being the most important one.
Yes, if you don't really know where the money's come from, you can't be sure it isn't criminal, and offshore provides the perfect wormhole down which criminal money can slide, only to re-emerge on the other side looking for all the world as if it is legitimate.
And Graham, I think you've hit upon something here, which kind of allows me, I think, to articulate my discomfort from the coverage that we've seen of the Pandora Papers so far. Because the story is not about the people. The story is about the structures.
Yes, right. It is. Absolutely.
And the more that we focus on individual people, and you can understand why readers are keen to do that, the more we detract from the real story, which is that these structures exist and can be used by lots and lots of people.
They can and of course do.
Mm. So that said, we should talk about how much is involved, shouldn't we?
Well, we should. And because of the nature of offshore, the estimates vary enormously, ranging from a conservative $5.6 trillion to a possibly rather exaggerated $32 trillion.
I'm not sure you could ever call $5.6 trillion, that's 12 zeros, bear in mind, a conservative amount, Graham.
No, Ray, I think you're right. And I think we should also talk a bit about what it means for that money to be offshore.
Very good point. Now, you might think that it's all just sitting in bank accounts, but that's probably not right.
And that's quite right, because a lot of these anonymous offshore companies will actually be holding assets which are most definitely not located in the same place as these companies are.
For example, a whole swathe of UK property is known to be owned by offshore companies.
But that's pretty much all we do know, because the UK government, sadly, has consistently failed to meet a promise of requiring all offshore companies who invest in UK property to reveal their underlying beneficial owners.
Wonder why that is.
I can't imagine, Ray.
But what you can say is that all this money in bank accounts or invested in property is a double whammy for the economies of most countries, and not in a good way.
I think you need to explain.
Well, sure. First of all, these are passive investments. They don't contribute to economic activity. It isn't funding research or industry or helping to provide jobs. And secondly, it distorts local economies because the need to shelter money of uncertain provenance is largely more interested in finding a safe home than the most economical methodology of doing so, then it's going to inflate prices.
Well, yes, and that also affects local economies because these properties are not usually bought as homes. Mm. So for most or sometimes all of the time, nobody lives there, and that means no one to shop in the local stores or send children to the local schools or frankly, all the other things that normal communities do.
And that's probably one of the biggest learning points from this leak. It doesn't tell us anything substantially new that hasn't come from previous leaks. There are new names and some new countries being dragged in, but essentially they're doing the same things we already knew about.
Yeah, but I guess what it does do, though, it reinforces just how widespread the problem is and hopefully will provide further impetus to stop looking at the problem as a them and us issue. Because the relationship between countries generating criminal or corrupt funds and those providing shelter for them is clearly symbiotic.
Ooh, symbiotic. One definition of which is denoting a mutually beneficial relationship between different people or groups. That's a great description. Yeah.
It is, isn't it? And it highlights yet again where the current system fails us so abysmally. If global money laundering is a symbiotic relationship between different jurisdictions, and if the role of offshore is to be the semi-permeable membrane that allows the osmotic flow between one and the other, national laws and mutual evaluations will never work to identify and address the problem properly.
Now, let me stop you there, Graham. I think we need to explain what you mean by saying that the role of offshore is to be the semi-permeable membrane, I wrote it down, that allows the osmotic flow between one and the other.
Well, firstly, I really fancied saying that sentence, but I think...
Well, so did I. That's why I repeated it.
It's good fun, isn't it? But I think you're right. And Ray, pick up the story, explain.
Okay, I'll do that. Now, osmosis, as you might remember from your school days, Graham, I think yours were in black and white mostly, is the way in which different concentrations of fluids tend to equalise in the presence of a semi-permeable membrane.
Yes, which is in effect a special type of cell wall that only allows traffic in one direction.
Exactly. It's how plants draw water from the soil, and it's why freshwater fish can't live in the sea, and vice versa.
Yes. So in our analogy, Ray, offshore is the semi-permeable membrane, which allows money to flow from areas with a high concentration of corruption or criminality to areas of high stability and transparency.
And the act of flowing through that membrane also bestows the magical quality on the assets of removing most evidence of their course, making it difficult to follow the money back in the other direction.
And just as is the case with different concentrations of liquids, where it's meaningless to talk about good or bad levels of concentration, we need to get away from talking about bad and good jurisdictions from a financial crime point of view.
Oh, definitely. If the safe home for criminal assets didn't exist, the temptation to steal is reduced. We live in a world where there is little desire to deal in cash, especially when it comes to significant assets and not just a bit of a hedonistic lifestyle. So the need to clean it up is essential.
Yeah, and we all know where those safe homes are, don't we?
I think we do. So what difference will publication of all these stories make?
Well, I think we need to look at the Panama Papers for a clue, Ray. Initially, when they were leaked, there was a huge impact from the reporting. But it took time and more investigation and continued pressure for changes to come about. But eventually, they did.
And it was helped by placing a lot of the material into the public domain through the Offshore Leaks website, which is still used today for further research and investigation. Mind you, we're already seeing real-world impact in some of the latest stories.
OK, so have you got an example we can share?
Yeah, there is news recently from the ICIJ, the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and that relates to publication of a story arising from the leak relating to indicted but now sadly deceased antiquities dealer Douglas Latchford.
Now, he is the British guy who was famous, or maybe I should say infamous, for dealing in Cambodian antiquities, isn't he?
Yep, he had an enormous personal collection, as well as selling a great many others to various museums around the world. After his death, his daughter donated the entire collection, estimated to be worth at least $50 million, to the Cambodian government, and it will now be displayed in the National Museum of Cambodia.
Well, hurrah to that. What role did the Pandora Papers play then?
Well, they revealed a complex web of corporate and trust structures created by Latchford for inheritance purposes, supposedly, that allowed them to identify at least 27 works of art linked to Latchford, which had ended up in major museums around the world.
And what about the response?
Well, many of them responded that they were in any case subject to live investigations, but one, the Denver Art Museum, has reportedly indicated that it will be returning 4 antiquities to Cambodia, which it acquired through Mr. Latchford.
Well, now that is really interesting and hopefully a sign of more to come. And it would be fantastic if at some point as much of that material arising from the leaks as possible is placed into the public domain so that a great many more sets of eyes can work through it to piece together hitherto unknown connections and extract even greater benefit from it.
I couldn't agree more, Graham. Often it's only with the benefit of some existing knowledge that we can make those connections and tell those stories. It's just in the nature of things that stories seldom leap off the page fully formed.
Yeah, absolutely. And there will be lots of people listening to this podcast who regularly access the Panama Papers and other leaks to supplement their own investigations and add further evidence to a due diligence file.
Oh, we certainly do.
All the time. It's one of our go-to places for open source intelligence.
But actually, this might in itself raise a point of controversy or possibly hazard, you know.
Okay, how?
Well, Graham, we've seen firms who are using Panama-enriched media search data in a very unnuanced and risk-averse way, haven't we?
Well, I think that's right, Ray. Sometimes just a hit on the Panama Papers database of a client or associated person's name might turn a client relationship into an undesired one and place it outside of risk appetite.
But that's a really blunt instrument, isn't it? We've established that not everyone using or even inquiring about using offshore structures is a crook. So I think we need a more nuanced response to such a hit, where we look at whether it is actually properly indicative of high-risk factors.
Yeah, now, whilst as a general point, Ray, I couldn't agree more. I mean, blunt instruments are bad, and more nuanced approaches are almost always better. I do wonder whether this unintended consequence of the disclosures might actually work in our favour.
How do you mean, Graham?
Well, Ray, if mere association with the Panama Papers or other leaks, whatever the nuance and context, is going to make it harder for you to access the mainstream financial system, the non-criminal users of these services might think again and decide to steer well clear of them.
Especially now that it's not only Mossack Fonseca leaks that they need to worry about, but effectively any corporate service provider, given that Pandora saw 14 other whistleblowers.
Yes, and that might be enough to see an end to the legitimate use of offshore, which means that criminal use would no longer be hidden. It is something to think about.
It is. I think it's likely that we'll be returning to this subject again in the future. And anyway, we've already lined up a few panels and presentations to discuss this further with the community. So anyone who's interested in finding out more, keep an eye on our Dark Money Files page on LinkedIn. Or for posts from either of us, letting you know when and where.
Exactly. And in the meantime, we were going to do a podcast, Ray, if you recall, about how to go about adjusting financial crime controls in the light of experience and changing typologies.
Well, like the publication of the Pandora Papers, for instance.
Exactly. And I think that's where we should go next.
I'm looking forward to it.
Thank you.